The themes and the content discussed in this program may be of an adult nature. It is not suitable for younger ears.
Live and local.
After the Watershed with Alison Ferns and BB Lynch.
Good evening.
Hello, Alison.
It's International Women's Day on Friday.
Yeah.
But last Sunday, it was International Sex Workers' Rights Day.
Yeah.
And so we thought tonight we would talk a little bit about what it's like to be a sex worker and whether or not the time has come to legalise sex work.
See, I have the pleasure of working with an ex-sex worker, Miranda Kane, and she's so brilliant and so fantastic and really has taught me so much about this, which of course I'm going to forget when we talk today. But in terms of when I speak to Miranda now, and she's totally for the decriminalisation of sex work, I don't understand what the argument against that is now. So I'm really interested to hear what we're going to hear today and see what people think, because people are heated about this.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think there are a lot of preconceptions about the people who use sex workers and the people who work in the industry. If this is something that you know a bit about, please share your story this evening. You can text us 81333. Start your message with the word radio.
Live and local, after the Watershed on BBC Sussex.
Because I suppose, you know, for most of us, our only real sort of knowledge of sex work is, you know, kind of, I'm thinking films like Pretty Woman, that programme that Billy Piper did, Diary of a Call Girl, and all of that kind of, you might say, glamorise it is probably the wrong word, but you know what I mean? It perhaps doesn't look at the kind of underbelly of that world.
Yeah.
Although, we were discussing it before you mentioned, you know, Miranda, your friend. Maybe there is a different side of it where actually women aren't being exploited. This is what they are choosing to do.
Exactly that. So with the media, so the Diary of a Call Girl and Pretty Woman, that's glamorising it. The other media make it so shoddy and seedy and exploitative. And it's so, I'm wondering if there's somewhere in the middle. When I talked to Miranda about this, her point is, I'm doing it and I'm getting paid for it and I'm in control and I'm earning more than I was earning on something else. And, you know, it's really transparent, the whole deal. It's an honest kind of exchange. And she doesn't feel exploited at all.
And I suppose the pros of legislating and making it legal is that then you would give sex workers rights.
Well, they're workers. And all workers need rights and protection. And today in Scotland, I think it was today in Scotland, the first ever sex workers joined a trade union.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I was reading actually in previous years, for International Women's Day, sex workers have kind of gone on strike. They've had a day of strike action in order to make the point that, as you say, they deserve rights just like any other worker. I suppose the argument against legalising sex work is that you are normalising it and saying, yeah, actually, this is okay. And there will be lots of people, some I'm sure who are listening this evening, who are outraged by the very idea.
Yeah. I just want people to be safe. And my feeling is if it's decriminalised, people are safer. I know that, you know, men and women who are sex workers, I know that the legislation is such that women can't work together now, which would be a safer way of working, that's suddenly running a brothel. So actually, it's interesting because I think actually paying for sex isn't illegal. It's going to a brothel or trying to pick up women like curb crawling.
Right. How would you feel if somebody you knew, a friend of yours, told you that they were going to become a sex worker?
Before I met Miranda, more concerned about it, I guess. Although I have had friends before who've been escorts, and that kind of developed into, you know, more than just, you know, sharing canapes. So I think I'm more broad-minded about it now. I'd want them to be safe.
Yeah.
I'd want them to be safe. There's we'll be talking to Nikki Adams, from the spokeswoman for the English Collective of Prostitutes, later. And she's fascinating about this, because they did a great bit of research comparing, the research is called What's a Nice Girl Like You Doing in a Job Like This? Brilliant. And it was comparing sex work and the rights and what goes on with other jobs that mainly women do.
Mm.
And guess what? Women in their other jobs are exploited too.
Well, yeah, there is that. When we talk to Nikki, we'll kind of clear up exactly what is legal and what isn't. But that's interesting in itself, that I don't think anyone's really sure. It's kind of a murky, yeah, grey area, isn't, yeah, it? I don't know where I stand on this. I mean, yes, I'm with you. Everybody should be safe. But I feel like a bit of a hypocrite because, okay, yeah, I say that on the one hand. If someone I knew, if my daughter wanted to become a sex worker, I would feel that they were being exploited. Even, and I know that there will be, perhaps even listening tonight, women who say, no, I'm not being exploited. I've chosen to do this. Mm. I could be on minimum wage, stacking shelves somewhere. Actually, I've got a really nice lifestyle thanks to this. And I do feel empowered and I do feel safe. And I don't feel that I'm being taken advantage of.
Is it less about exploitation and more about morality?
I don't know.
I met a woman who was a sex worker, and she came out to her friends and family about it, and then her sister decided to become a sex worker as well.
Wow.
Now, when I first heard that, I was like, something was going on at home. You know, I instantly, yeah, went into, what's going on? And then now less so.
I guess a lot of it's about how you view sex, isn't it? I mean, I don't know, but I imagine if you are going to into this line of work, you have to detach yourself, don't you, from the sexual act. It becomes something more,
a transaction.
Yeah.
But then maybe a lot of sex, well, in any relationship, you know, in relationships is a transaction.
There is that. I would be fascinated to speak to somebody who has actually used the services of a sex worker, because again, talking about preconceptions and what have you, I think just now having this conversation, we've probably all got a picture in our mind's eye of the sort of man who goes to visit a prostitute, and we're probably way off the mark.
Yeah.
That's the truth of it.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear from you, if that's you. Have you ever been to visit a sex worker? And we're saying men, but women increasingly now employ the services of male escorts.
Yes.
And what have you.
So other cars are available, but yes.
Nikki Adams joins us, spokeswoman for the English Collective of Prostitutes. Nikki, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, can I just clear something up? So it's interesting. I said spokeswoman there for the English Collective of Prostitutes. Is that still an okay term to use, or do you prefer sex worker?
Well, we actually use both, but we tend to keep, we've held on to our name, English Collective of Prostitutes, just because we feel that while we're criminalised and stigmatised, we're treated like prostitutes, and so we're going to hang on to the name, reclaiming the name,
yeah,
until we get decriminalisation, and then we might reconsider it.
Sure. Talking about the legal side of things, we're not quite sure what's legal, what isn't. Could you just kind of clarify that for us?
Well, it's not illegal to be a sex worker, so the job is completely legal, but if you work on the street or work together with a friend from premises, you can be prosecuted. And the charges are actually quite heavy. On, you know, for example, two women working together from a flat can be prosecuted for brothel keeping. And the maximum sentence for that is 7 years in prison. So it's a very heavy charge. We've also, yeah, had women working together in premises who are actually done for controlling prostitution, as in controlling each other, which is clearly absurd and outrageous. And it's also illegal for men to solicit for sex on the street.
Right.
I don't, hang on. Hi, Nikki, it's Bibi. I don't understand.
Hi, Bibi.
Hello. What do you mean controlling the sex worker if there's two women working together? Aren't they just protecting each other?
Yes. And in fact, you know, we have a new campaign, Make All Women Safe. And that really highlights the injustice of the laws because, you know, as I said, it's not actually illegal to be a sex worker. But if you work together, you are treated as a criminal. You're at risk of prosecution. And most women would want to work together with somebody else inside, usually, because it's safer and warmer. And working with somebody is definitely a big protection against violence. Mm. But that act is actually illegal, and that's what you can get prosecuted for. And prosecutions are very common. I mean, there's very big police sweeps against sex workers on the street. And the number of raids and prosecutions for women working together inside has really gone up too. And it is, it really puts us much more at risk of violence. You know, on the street, if you, ideally, if you were on the street, you'd just want to work nearby someone else. You know, you'd want to be able to have someone take down the registration number of the car you were getting into. You'd want time to be able to check out the client, make sure there wasn't anyone else in the car. You know, in premises, you, if the, you're contacted by a client, you want to be able to ask him his real name, for example. All those basic security measures that sex workers spend a lot of time and energy and often even money trying to stay safe, all those measures actually put us more at risk of arrest.
Why do you think the police are, there are more raids? Because you'd imagine there's more pressing crimes.
Yes, you would, wouldn't you? I know. You know, so often we work very closely with Women Against Rape, and they point to the very low conviction rate for reported rapes. And, you know, they have a lot of women in their network who have suffered sexual violence and have not been able to get the police to act. You know, not sex workers, women generally. And but still, we see 25 police officers turning up at the door of a flat where there are just two women working. And you think, God, that's a really terrible squandering of precious police resources. And they could be doing something much more useful. But I think there's two reasons why the raids and arrests have gone up. One is that there's a lot of misinformation being put out about trafficking, saying that the majority of sex workers are trafficked. And in fact, it's actually not true, number one. But in any case, raiding premises doesn't help genuine victims of trafficking. All it does is push everyone underground, makes everyone fearful of the police, because what often happens in those raids is that sex workers get arrested and deported if you're a migrant woman. So that's one, but that's one motivation. I think, you know, the police get funding for trafficking, and one way of them showing that they're doing something about it is to be able to say they're raiding premises. But the other reason is the proceeds of crime law, which came in 2002 and has kind of been gathering momentum and is used quite commonly now. And there, you, they don't even have to convict you of prostitution, and they can put a hold on all your income. They can seize your anything that you have in the bank. They can seize your house, your car, your jewelry. They can take every penny from you, all onto the, you know, all with the assumption that all of those assets have been earned through an illegal act. So, and you have to prove it's not.
On the subject of exploitation, we did actually approach the National Police Chief Council on this, and we were given a statement by the Assistant Chief Constable, Dan Vajdovic, and he is quoted as saying, sex workers are all too often individuals who are abused and profited from, with around 30 to 40% of all reported exploitation being sexual exploitation. The police priority must be to ensure the safety of vulnerable people and crack down on those who use their position to exploit them. Now, I don't know if it's just me, but when I read that, and I think a lot of people actually have this kind of idea that when you're talking about sex workers, that you are talking about sort of a man in a sort of pimp role, and he's kind of in control, and he's making these girls, these women, do his bidding, and he's the one taking all the money.
I mean, they're addicts.
Yeah, and that, rightly or wrongly, I think that is the image a lot of people have.
Yeah, I think the thing about that kind of scenario is, first of all, it's based on a lot of misinformation. And, you know, we have a big problem as sex workers because most of us can't be public or speak publicly. Mm. And so the public view
of
who sex workers
are,
yeah, it's really distorted. In fact, I mean, what Dan Vajdovic should be saying is that the majority of sex workers are mothers who are working to support families and deserve the same kind of safety and protection as other people. And if there is a crime of exploitation or trafficking or rape or other violence or threats or false imprisonment, there are laws against those crimes, and those should be vigorously enforced and implemented. But sex work as it stands at the moment, the laws that govern sex work are not helping us stay safe. They're actually putting us more at risk. And that has to change. If those laws were abolished, we actually would be able to deal with the actual crime and exploitation within sex work more easily. Women would be able to come forward. At the moment, if you come forward to report a robbery or rape, more often than not, instead of your attackers being investigated, you're the one that ends up in court being charged with prostitution. And that has to stop.
Nikki, so why hasn't decriminalisation happened yet?
I think the public generally is on our side. They do understand that criminalisation undermines safety. And we do have a good model of what the law could look like, which has already been brought in New Zealand and has been there for, I think, about 18 years, something like that. And it hasn't led to massive increase in prostitution, no increase at all, in fact. And it has really improved sex workers' health and safety.
They
removed prostitution from the criminal law. That's the crucial thing. It means that sex workers can work on the street. There are some regulations. For example, you can't solicit outside a church, but then you can't do a lot of things outside. You know, you can't set up a factory right next to a church. You know what I mean? Or you can't set up a factory right next to a school, or you would hope you wouldn't be able to. And then they actually decriminalized so that women can work together in premises. Up to four women can work if they're in charge of their own money and their own working hours. They can just work together without any kind of certificate or anything like that. And for if somebody actually wants to set up a brothel and run a brothel, there is a certificate scheme. But it's quite a light touch certificate scheme. You can't run a brothel if you've got a conviction for a violent offense, that kind of thing. And it's worked very, very well. The biggest change that they say is that what sex workers say is that, first of all, they feel like they have much more rights. They feel like they have the law on their side, which makes a big difference. And the relationship with the police has been completely transformed. And that could work here. I think that the stigma and discrimination, and with a big dose of morality, stops people wanting to speak out, in defense of sex workers. But I think it's changing. I think a lot of younger women, feminists, women that would call themselves feminists, you know, they now say, well, look, I don't even know about all the ins and outs, but I think we should listen to what sex workers say. And current sex workers say we want decriminalization.
Can I ask you two things, Nikki? So first of all, I wonder if there'd be less clients, punters, Johns, I don't know what the word is, if it was decriminalised. You know, is the part of the taboo for people that come to see you?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it works either way. I think, you know, prostitution, the level of prostitution is much more driven by, you know, women's need for money than men's desire for sex, really. I think that, you know, we've seen big increases in prostitution, especially in some places they say it's like 166% increase in street prostitution. And that's directly related to the introduction of benefit sanctions, where people just got cut off benefits. You know, women got cut off benefits
that's
and they
here.
Had no income whatsoever. That's here. That's in Sheffield, actually. That's what they said about Sheffield. You know, so if you cut a woman's benefits and she has absolutely no money, especially if she's got kids to feed, what did you think was going to happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then they're astonished that there's a rise in prostitution.
Yeah, but that's so depressing, isn't it? I mean, that's a woman
who is horrifying.
Desperate.
There's 1.5 million people destitute in this country. That is very depressing. You know, all the people there's such a hidden level of poverty and near starvation going on in this country. It's just horrifying. You know, you do hear about it. You hear about it here and here and here, but nobody really puts it together and say, okay, there's a real crisis, particularly for women and particularly for mothers.
I'm going to ask you something, Nikki. Now, when I asked Miranda and I interviewed Brooke McNanty, and Miranda told me off for asking this question, but I wouldn't be a journalist if I didn't. Please forgive me for the obvious question, but I know people would be interested. I don't know if you have children. If you did have a daughter, how would you feel if she went into sex work?
Well, I think our new campaign would help me, actually. If I was not a sex worker myself and my daughter went into sex work, since we've been doing this new campaign, Make All Women Safe, the crucial thing about that is saying, you know, however you personally feel about sex work, in some ways, put that aside and focus on the fact that some women are doing this job in order to earn a living. And why wouldn't you want them to be safer? Wouldn't you want them to be safe? So let's help, let's get rid of the laws that prevent women working together, and so we can work more safely. And, you know, make sure that we can leave prostitution if we want to, make sure we have the resources to leave prostitution if we want to. And I think that's how I would tackle it now if I had a daughter. I don't, I have a son, but if I had a daughter, I kind of think, well, look, you're doing that. Me telling you not to is probably not going to make any difference anyway. And I definitely want you to be safer. And I want you to be able to have the option of leaving if and when you're ready.
Nikki, can I ask how you got started?
Well, I started when I was quite young, actually, and I don't think I'd have called myself a sex worker at that time. And I've worked in all different areas of the sex industry. And, you know, at some point in my life, I thought about this, and at some point in my life, I had a friend who, a male friend, who had loads and loads of time and was able to kind of hang out with me during the day and do very, you know, play sport and various things. And I kind of said to him, how come? You know, what job do you do? And he said, I'm a firefighter. And I thought, that is the way to get a higher wage. You have to go and do the men's jobs. And I actually started training as a firefighter, which then didn't work out. And that is really one of the reasons I eventually went back into sex work, was because the other jobs are so rubbish. I mean, they're, you know, women's work is so low paid and exploitative. And with the 0-hour contracts now, and if I, you know, when I was, you know, single mums, my friends who are single mums, I don't know how they survive. I don't know how, what job you can do as a single mum that pays you enough to cover the cost of childcare. You know, mothers are so disparaged and unsupported in society. That's really what should be paid attention to.
Well, I was shocked by that statistic, and you sort of alluded to it earlier. Over 90% of sex workers in the UK are mothers. I mean,
over 90% are women.
Yeah.
About 70% are mothers.
Right. I mean, on that, is it possible to have a private life? This is a question from John in Chichester. Is it possible to have your own private life, i.e. a partner, a family, and still kind of have all of that alongside a career in the sex industry?
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, I was really interested in, I caught the end of your discussion just before I came on the line. And, you know, the thing about sex, you know, you were talking about sex, and, you know, of course, a lot of us have this idea about sex, you know, it being part of a romantic relationship and, you know, being satisfying. But I have to say that the reality for many women is that we have sex for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes it's for money, for those of us that are sex workers. And, you know, it's not such a alien, you know, it's not such an alien experience to have sex when you're not completely in it and enjoying it and all the rest of it. So I don't think it's so difficult to understand that for sex workers, we just get on with it. It's sometimes the least intrusive part of the job. You know, having to talk and entertain people is exhausting.
You're telling me.
You know,
your partner? I mean, I can't even imagine explaining to your boyfriend or your husband, oh, I'm going out to work now, and they know what you're going out to do.
Well, I don't have a boyfriend or a husband. I have a girlfriend. Actually, I have a wife. So, but they don't, you know, it depends on, I mean, people see it, people register and recognize that it's a job like other jobs. And, you know, the whole question of physical intimacy, we did this piece of research comparing sex work to other women's work. And when you hear midwives and nurses and care workers talk about their job, you know, one woman was telling me that she was working as a sex worker and also working as a care worker. Sorry, working as a care worker and then supplementing her income with sex work. And she said she had a client in a care home, and she, in the morning, she went to see him as a carer, and in the evening, she went to see him as a sex worker. Seriously. I mean, it was like one of those really fluky things. And she said, for her, the only difference was what she wore. In fact, the working as a carer, she had a lot more intimate contact than she did as a sex worker. And then, of course, I asked her, and I said, well, how much you get paid? you know, and of course, how much she got paid as a sex worker, I think it was 3.5 times more than she got paid as a care worker.
Wow.
And she said there was no difference. You know, you still, you know, you do a lot of, there's a lot of jobs where people have to do a lot of intimate work, you know.
On that note, thank you, Nikki. It's been fascinating. Nikki Adams, spokeswoman for the English Collective of Prostitutes. I don't know what I think now.
See, this is what I'm saying. It moves your head, doesn't it?
It does.
It's good.
You see, you speak to someone like Nikki, though, and she sounds like, you know, she's kind of, she's made a choice, yeah, and she is empowered.
She doesn't
and she's,
sound emotionally damaged by it.
She doesn't. But then you hear her talk about, you know, how, you know, she thinks she has seen a direct correlation between benefit cuts and then more people taking to the streets to sell their bodies. And that makes me think, well, that's not a choice, is it? That's people who have been left with no other option than to sell themselves, but quite literally.
And that is a moral issue, but not a morality in terms of how we normally look at it, but in terms of why the government or why governments, why we're in the situation, why austerity has results in this. So, like she says, rather than concentrate on the prostitution and sex work and the legality of that, around, let's look at the culture around society that is making people that don't want to do it but don't have a choice do it.
If you've ever been to a sex worker, if you've ever used their services, it'd be really interesting to hear from you this evening. And of course you can do so confidentially, you know what I mean, you can come on anonymously. I completely understand you might not want to tell the world that you have visited a sex worker. I mean, I suppose, I think, you know, anecdotally I've heard stories where, you know, male friends of mine have gone to Amsterdam and, you know, in their younger days, and the whole red light district, and, you know, had a little dalliance with someone in a red lit window. You then hear kind of sadder stories where, you know, people are just craving some sort of physical intimacy, maybe not even sexual, but they just want some closeness with a member of the opposite sex. I'm just trying to think of the different reasons why somebody might visit a sex worker. I mean, imagine if you were with a man or a woman for that matter, and you found out that they were using a sex worker behind your back. That would hurt.
It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt him more.
Eventually.
Eventually. I think it is so interesting. I think, I don't know where you go with it. I mean, is there a problem with it? That maybe there shouldn't, where we're saying people can be anonymous and they call. Maybe if people, I mean, not saying people should be that open, but if they did, maybe the taboo would go. And then, but then would there still be a profession? Would the supply demand situation change? Nikki thought not.
Obviously, we did approach the Home Office for their thoughts on this. They say there are no plans to change the law around prostitution, but they do recognise the need for more evidence in this area. Interestingly, they go on to say there is no unequivocal evidence that shows a change in the law for prostitution or paying for sex would protect vulnerable people rather than exposing them to further harm. They say the government is providing £100 million in funding to tackle all forms of violence against women and girls.
Yeah, but can I say something else about the Home Office? They think that there's no correlation between less police and rising knife crime. So I'd suggest that you take advice from people in the industry, in the profession.
And again, you know, I'm saying if you've ever visited a sex worker, get in touch. But also, have you ever worked as a sex worker? And of course, there's lots of different roles in that, isn't it? Obviously, you know, we were talking there to Nikki Adams from the English Collective of Prostitutes. So there's obviously, you know, people who are doing that. But I mean, would you say, I don't know, working in a lap dancing club, giving, you know, private dances, is that a form of sex work? Where do you draw the line?
I think from my experience with people I've met through working with Miranda, I think people do think that lap dancing is sex work, and, you know, all that scale of work. But I've totally lost what I was going to say about that. It was about the work. It was, you say something, Ali. What was I going to say?
It's like the whole high class escort thing. And I mentioned Belle de Jour earlier. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I used to love that program, the series with Billy Piper. But that did kind of glamorise it. I mean, I've got a little clip.
Let's have a listen.
I mean, this kind of says it all, really.
I don't need a boyfriend when I've got regulars like Al. He pays well and there's no bullshit. No games. What are you in the mood for?
You.
Perfect. You are, yeah.
Good.
You are. See? easy. Sex, enthusiasm, respect, clarity.
You see, she's painting a very positive picture of what it's like to be a kind of, I suppose, what you would call a high-class call girl, hooker, whatever.
Yeah, well, when we interviewed Brooke McNanty, who is Belshaw, she was really positive about it, and she saw it as a really empowering choice, and it was a job that she wanted to do at that time, and she did at that time. And I do think, you know what I will say about this, the whole range of sex work, what I have found brilliant about it is it's a real community. And they all really look out for each other and are very supportive. And it feels less daunting to me, that world now, because I've met a lot of the women around it. Mm. And it just seems like they really care about each other, and they know. They know how it should be.
Mm. You're listening to After the Watershed on BBC Sussex and BBC Surrey with me, Alison Ferns.
And me, Bibi Lynch.
I can't stop thinking about Nikki Adams, who we spoke to earlier, a sex worker who was talking about somebody she knew in the industry who was working as a carer during the day, yeah, looking after a certain gentleman, yeah, and then supplementing her income in the evening, and came across the same gentleman.
You might want to rephrase that.
Yes. But, I mean, that's awkward, isn't it? I mean, if you are a sex worker, I'm still struggling with this idea of how you keep that part of your life separate from the rest of your life. And I know Nikki said that her partner, you know, and other people's partners are fine about it. I wouldn't be.
So, one of the women I knew who was a sex worker, her boyfriend would be in the flat at the same time.
I mean, that's, I just don't, I can't get my
Maybe
head around that.
Maybe that was his thing. But you'd feel more secure.
Well, yeah.
Would he be arrested for being a pimp?
Well, we've had this text from someone who says, I have used sex workers in Germany in a legal building rather than the red light district. The red light district is unchecked for STDs, where the buildings are on an actual high street, and the women are regularly checked. I used to go in the same manner as going to the cinema. Wow, that's one way of looking at it. It's just me and her. We have a bit of chat, etc. There was a moment of sex, but it was mostly chat. See, that goes back to what I was saying earlier. Is it always about intercourse, or is it, for some people, they just like the idea of having that moment of intimacy?
Yeah, or it's just the spice that their relationship needs. I mean, it could be a million reasons that they've got a kink that they don't want to ask their partner to partake in.
This texter goes on to say there have been reports where women came from the Dusseldorf premises where the Turkish men were beating the women up. So that kind of goes back to that kind of exploitation thing. Mm. As the women feel their only interest in the money, they can get off the clients, and some will fleece them and others will charge the standard rate. Dan Boucher joins us on the line, Director of Public Affairs at CARE, that's Christian Action Research and Education. Dan, we spoke earlier to Nikki Adams, spokeswoman for the English Collective of Prostitutes. She was talking about a model she would like to see introduced in this country in terms of decriminalising sex work. Have a listen. This is how they do things in New Zealand.
We do have a good model of what the law could look like, which has already been brought in New Zealand and has been there for, I think, about 18 years, something like that. And it hasn't led to massive increase in prostitution, no increase at all, in fact. And it has really improved sex workers' health and safety.
Dan, is that something you could see working here?
No, I have to say that our understanding of the way that the New Zealand model is very different from that of Nikki's. I mean, I've actually been privileged to take women from New Zealand who've worked in the New Zealand context to see parliamentarians to tell them what a dreadful system the New Zealand system is, and how they were exploited terribly under decriminalisation. And really coming here to warn us not to go there. One lady particularly, Sabrina Valisi, for example, you can read up her story on the BBC website. She came over in 2017. And actually, she was an interesting one because she actually thought that decriminalisation was going to be a really good thing when it came in 2003, and was actually advocated for it, but basically saw that what it it led to was the normalization of prostitution. It did not result in any sense in better protections for women. More people were involved in the industry. It kind of normalized the commodification of people and buying people. She was very disappointed. It didn't actually lead to greater rights and power for women. She now campaigns actually for the opposite. Talking about prostitution law reform, there are sort of two poles of the debate. And at one end, you've got the New Zealand decriminalisation model. On the other end, you've got what's described as the Nordic model, where you actually make it a crime to pay for sex, the abolitionist model that was pioneered in Sweden and is now used in Norway and Ireland and Canada and France and various other countries, where basically in those societies they've said it is not appropriate to treat people as commodities and to buy them. The data in those contexts, there is no magic bullet, but in those contexts what we have seen is a reduction in overall levels of prostitution and the suffering associated with it. I think one of the big questions here how do we view prostitution? Do we see it as a valid form of work? And you have to ask yourself when you kind of look at some of this basic profile from research, the things that are associated with it. Recent research saying that 61% of women in prostitution have experienced violence. 68% of women basically exhibited symptoms that were similar to or met the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder, very high levels of anxiety and depression. 32% of women in prostitution having actually entered prostitution illegally, effectively, under the age of 18. There are all these cosy, romantic sort of depictions sometimes of prostitution, but in real life, for the vast majority of people, it's really, really unpleasant. For me, I don't regard it as a valid form of work, and I don't think we should dignify it in that way. I think that we have to, particularly, obviously, most people who buy women are men, and I think that there is a need for men to rise up and say this is not appropriate. And,
hi Dan, it's so Phoebe here.
Hi.
Hello. If it's appropriate work or not, or not deemed a proper job or not, it is happening. And as Nikki was saying, with 0-hour contracts and austerity and wages being so awful, women, mainly women, are being sex work, whatever the model, however if we like that or we don't like that. So shouldn't those women be protected?
Well, this is one of the I think myths that if you go for the kind of decriminalisation model, that makes women safe. As I said, the experience of the women that we have spoken to from New Zealand is that it doesn't make it any safer. I mean, one of the interesting things you talked about Germany earlier, and the rationale for introducing the German model is that it will be regulated and it'll be much safer for women. What's actually happened in Germany is you've created two sex markets, one that is regulated, but the unregulated one has continued the same as ever, because surprise surprise, there are a lot of pimps that don't want to have to pay taxes, and actually what's happened is that the total amount of prostitution going on in Germany has increased significantly. It's been described to me as a little bit like sticking a flag up to traffickers and saying send your women here, because traffickers know that if they send women to Germany, there's a nice legal framework that's going to enable them to make lots of money. I mean, conversely, very interestingly, there have been phone conversations intercepted by the police in a context like Sweden, where traffickers are saying, don't bother sending women here, because they know they have to spend a lot of money trying to evade detection, which will cut into their profit margins. And at the end of the day, this is all about making money for them.
What does CARE suggest then?
Well, we suggest that the best way forward would be to introduce the Nordic model and go with the way that the Swedes have done it. We're not suggesting that if you make an offence to pay for sex, that it will miraculously make prostitution go away. We're into a context where we're trying to limit the suffering that's associated with prostitution and empowering women. I mean, the Nordic model actually decriminalises the seller, who usually is the woman, but makes this an offence for the purchaser to purchase in any context, which makes it easy for the women, normally women, to talk to the police because they haven't committed any crime. It works well in the sense that it results in reductions in trafficking. And obviously, if you look globally, different times it has changed, but in recent years, the number one reason for women to be referred to the national referral mechanism, having been trafficked, is they've been trafficked for sex, or the number two, it's either come at one or two, so it's one of the major drivers for trafficking into this country. The Nordic model challenges that by making a defence to pay for sex. And it makes it more expensive for the pimps, because the pimps have to try and evade detection, and that cuts into their profit margins, and so they'll, makes other forms of making money more interesting to them to kind of be very, crude about it. At the end of the day, for them, it's just about making money, and they are usually men who are exploiting women and using them to.
But a lot of women are in it for making money, because that's because there's no other work that's paying.
Is there always a pimp involved? And when we talked earlier to Nikki Adams, I kind of got the impression that's not always the case.
It often is the case, but no, I'm not saying it is always the case. Any more than I'm saying that the Nordic model is a magic bullet. I don't think there is a perfect sort of, as usually the case if you're looking at a public policy challenge, there generally isn't a magic solution. It's all usually the case of trying to create a system which makes things better, not that makes things perfect. And when you look at the suffering that's associated with prostitution, as I said again, 68% of people in prostitution exhibiting the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is not a kind of just a regular happy job. When you look at those kind of things, in my judgment, you have to say, as a society, do we want to say, okay, this is a valid form of work, this is fine, we're happy for people to make money in this kind of a way, we're happy for people to be treated as commodities and for other people to buy them. The Nordic model is not just simply about criminalising the buyer. It's also about saying that, obviously you need to provide, usually women, in prostitution with roots out. You need to support them to help them find an alternative form of work. And we're very clear that, if you're just to come in suddenly making a defence to pay for sex and just kind of not do anything else, that wouldn't be appropriate. There has to be a two-stage process. There has to be make it an offence to pay for sex, and then you have to have a strategy to help, as I say, usually women, find the routes out from prostitution and alternative forms of employment that aren't associated with having a 68% likelihood of having a post-traumatic stress disorder or 61% chance of having experienced violence.
And I completely take what you're saying. Obviously, you've done a lot of research, and you're talking about the kind of impact, psychologically it has on these women. I completely understand all of that. But I suppose there's part of me that thinks, you're never going to get rid of it. They call it the oldest profession for a reason. So if it is happening, then surely we need to kind of look at a way of protecting these people. Dan Boucher, thank you so much for joining us down there from the Christian Action Research and Education. There was a lot of talk there about, if you do decriminalise it, it makes it safer for sex workers. I guess it also makes it safer for people who are buying sex. And obviously Dan's saying, actually, they think that it makes sense to criminalise the purchase of sex. One of the most shocking things, and I was shocked, I was very young and naive at the time. We were on holiday, and we were sat at this bar, and there was an American dad, and I was thinking, what was he doing? You could see he was sort of bartering, some sort of, it was this young girl. He was buying a woman for his son. Ooh. For his 18th birthday. He was like, it was like his 18th gift to his son.
I think I got driving lessons.
Was it? Do you know what I mean? And you're just like, whoa. But then I remember that in the news, probably about a year ago, 2 years ago, I forgot her name. Is it Kathy Letts? She was talking about how she'd considered sort of paying for a prostitute for her son, because he has sort of learning needs and what have you. So, I don't know. I'm more confused about this whole subject than when we first started the show. And also, I'm aware that we're hearing lots of different statistics, lots of different research. Some people say, actually, if you look at it, it's not damaging to women. Yeah. Others saying it is. Lucy Platt is the Professor of Public Health and Epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And you have done a lot of research in this area, haven't you, Lucy?
Yes, that's right. We've just undertaken a review of public health, social science evidence, try and synthesise this rich body of evidence that looks at how criminalisation might affect sex workers' safety, sexual and emotional health, and access to health and social care services. What we found from synthesising all the quantitative evidence, the survey data sets across many countries in low and high income settings, that sex workers who'd experienced repressive policing, including less imprisonment, being displaced to another area to work, and having condoms confiscated, were times more likely to experience instances of violence, sexual or physical violence by any party.
Sorry to interrupt. Did you say condoms confiscated?
Well, yes. We searched the literature to identify different types of police enforcement practices that took place, and often condoms are confiscated as evidence of sex work.
Wow.
So this practice along with arrest and imprisonment, increased risk of violence, as well as increasing risk of HIV and STIs, and increases risk of the practice of using condoms for sex with clients. And some of the reasons why this happened is because the fact that if sex workers are concerned about being arrested or of their own arrest, or even of their client's arrest, means they rush negotiations with clients and don't screen clients sufficiently, or work in more isolated areas, and that makes them more vulnerable to theft and violence.
I think as well, I mean, I don't know if you found this when you were carrying out the research, but because it is a sort of hidden industry, if you like, and because people are worried about the consequences of talking openly about what they do, I guess it's harder in a way, isn't it, to actually kind of get proper research in this area and actually draw some proper conclusions.
Well, I mean, there's actually a very rich body of evidence, surveys conducted among sex workers. And I mean, we identified in our review 86 studies across 33 countries. We synthesized both qualitative research, including interviews and focus groups with sex workers, and so synthesized data from over 2,000 interviews with sex workers. So I think, although it's a challenging area to conduct research because of the stigma associated with sex work, and also fears and harms associated with criminalization, concerns about being out about sex work, it's a challenging area to do research, but there is a rich body of evidence.
With the kind of ultimate conclusion from your research, I'm quoting this, is there is an urgent need to reform sex work related laws and institutional practices so as to reduce harms and barriers to the realisation of health. How would that happen?
Well, the public health evidence clearly shows the harms associated with sex work criminalisation, including purchase and organisation of sex is criminalised, so that's making it illegal to work with others in flats. And it clearly shows the need to decriminalise sex work. I think that the research also shows that just decriminalisation alone is not enough, and we must also tackle sort of the broader sort of inequalities in society, increasing access to housing and welfare, changing and more inclusive immigration policies that don't marginalise migrants, as well as tackling discrimination and stigma against sex work.
It's a very, very complex issue, Luce, isn't it? Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. We've had this text from someone who says, when it comes to the purchasing of sex, is it really any different to regular relationships where if the boyfriend does his household chores, then he'll get sex at the end of the week? Or girlfriends that expect to be given money and then the boyfriend is lured in some respect to getting sex off her? These are simple rumours slash hearsay rather than fact. I did know somebody once actually all made all sorts of promises if she could get a new kitchen. I mean, you know, I know that sounds like I'm...
You're awful.
But no, but you know, I kind of see what they're... You know, if it goes back to that thing, if it's a transaction, it's a transaction. I don't know.
Here's another text. Unsure on the red light district in regards to pimps. The premises that are run have a madam, and she manages the money, security and banning of bad clients. The girl I went with simply left because she had a plan, an actual plan. You know, it's so depressing to me, the dehumanisation of the women, mainly women. You know, if there's going to be a raid, you don't take their jewellery. You know, it's such a... Confiscating condoms. It's so extraordinary, isn't it? And I just don't understand. You know, we're hearing all these different, you know, like you say, stats and research and points of view. But I don't understand why the women themselves aren't being listened to. You'd imagine they would...
But then do they really have a voice? Because they're understandably concerned about the repercussions, I guess, of being vocal and going public.
But the English Collective of Prostitutes, there's a voice.
Gosh, and I guess that's why on Sunday they had this day, you know, International Sex Workers' Rights Day. Will we ever see it decriminalised in this country? I don't know. I'm not so sure we will. But who knows?
Live and local.
After the Watershed with Alison Ferns and BB Lynch.